New York City, this is Film Spotting, Streaming Video Unit. I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Coming up on this week's show, He Who Smelt It, Dealt It. Allison and I rail against the much-maligned adaptation of Ayn Rand's famous objectivism-slash-trains-slash-metallurgy-slash-corporate-intrigue-drama, Atlas Shrugged. We'll also bring you our picks for the most interesting new and expiring streaming titles.
But first, Q-Shots, our listings of notable films on Netflix and other VOD sites and services, all centered around a theme that connects back to this week's review. This week, inspired by our discussion of Atlas Shrugged Part 1, all 19 parts of our picks for great, ponderous examinations of governmental malfeasance. Book to film adaptations. That's what we settled on.
Yeah. I was really pushing for the governmental malfeasance podcast.
It's catchy. It's really irresistible.
Huge. It was going to be huge. But we'll save that for another time. You know, we're just getting started here on SVU. There's plenty of time for that. Yeah, book to film adaptations. It tied in nicely with Atlas Shrugged Part 1. And there was also a great piece on the AV Club this week by Scott Tobias and Tasha Robinson, a little back and forth crosstalk about this very subject. It was inspired by The Hunger Games, the huge blockbuster success based on the huge blockbuster book. And it was sort of debating what makes a good adaptation of a book. Is it faithfulness? Is it just the quality of the movie? And I don't know what you think about this, Allison, but my opinion sort of jived more with what Scott was saying in this piece, which was basically that it's all about the quality. I don't really care how faithful you are to the book. The book is the book. The movie is the movie. I'm watching the movie, and I want the movie to be good, and I don't really care if it's a quote-unquote good adaptation. To me, if it's a good movie, that makes it a good adaptation, or it makes it irrelevant whether or not it's a good adaptation. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you make a good movie, people are going to say, oh, that was a great adaptation, whether or not that's technically true.
Yeah, I agree. And also, it always worries me a little when you hear that someone's adapting a book that they've loved for a long time and that they've been a huge fan of, because it usually means that they're so close to it that it can be difficult to get the distance you need to cut the parts that don't work, to change the things that don't work on screen. A movie is a very different thing from a book and often requires condensing and requires trimming of characters. And, you know, in the case of something like The Hunger Games, you've got a huge fan base who basically they want to see
yes.
the thing they love on screen.
They're walking in with a checklist.
Yes.
And if they don't see the things on that checklist, if they can't cross them off, they're not going to be satisfied.
Right. And so in that case, you really don't have that much freedom to change things, though I think there are certainly better things that can be done in terms of how you visualize them.
Right.
But yeah, in general, I do agree that it's much better to aim for having what's best for your movie than having what's closest to the book.
Right. And I mean, in terms of that checklist idea, that's how I felt seeing The Hunger Games, because I haven't read the books and I just felt like I was seeing, you know, someone going through the motions, essentially. And if you love the books, I'm sure you probably love the movie because you got to see all these things that you've been waiting to see that have been living in your imagination. But for someone who didn't have that, who hadn't seen these things, who didn't have those things in his imagination, it felt lacking to me.
Yeah.
I don't know about
well,
you.
Well, and I think that I don't know that I necessarily go to the movies to see a direct translation of a book that I've read. You know, I don't think I need that experience.
Right,
that much.
But there are people who do.
There are, and there's a lot of money to be made in doing this, so we're going to keep seeing this happen.
All right, so Allison and I each have three book-to-film adaptations here that we're going to discuss in Q-Shots this week. And in terms of my picks, I guess based on what I've been saying here, I didn't really go for movies that are great adaptations of books. In maybe all of these cases, I guess two out of the three cases, I haven't even read the books, which I guess maybe is ignorance on my part or illiteracy on my part. But in some ways, it's a statement, too, in that I don't care about the book. You know, I just want the movie to be good. I want a good movie. And maybe the good movie will encourage me to read the book, but probably not, because I'm apparently illiterate and don't care about books. But that's really what I was going for. Was there any sort of organizing principle around your picks, Allison?
I haven't read any of the books.
Hmm.
So, I think that
we're making a statement here.
We are. Unintentional on my part, but,
yes.
Oh, but I stand by it anyway.
It was very deliberate on
my
part. All right, well, let me start with this first one. This is available on Netflix Instant, and it is The Long Goodbye from 1973, directed by Robert Altman, written by Lee Brackett, and based on the classic novel by Raymond Chandler. A very unusual adaptation of a Philip Marlowe novel. Of course, there's many of them throughout the history of cinema. This one opens with Private Eye Philip Marlowe, played by the unlikely casting of Elliot Gould, waking in his apartment in 1973. And it's almost as if he's woken from a Rip Van Winkle-ish coma of some kind from the 1940s or 50s into the 1970s. You know, he's this character who seems a little bit out of time. He's sort of walking around in this decadent, hedonistic, venal, greedy decade, and he's sort of this heroic, kind of bumbling, kind of idealistic working class hero in a way. You know, he doesn't fit in where he is now.
He looks ridiculous.
And it does make him look a little bit ridiculous. The opening scene, which has absolutely nothing to do with the plot, but sets the tone in a really nice way, is him waking from this sleep by his cat, who's hungry. And the cat only wants to eat a certain kind of cat food. So he has to go out at 3 a.m. to find cat food. He can't find the brand. His cat is a very particular brand. The cat won't eat the cat food. So he takes the food he finds home, puts it in the can that's supposed to be the cat's favorite, but the cat still won't. The cat knows.
There's a long goodbye.
Your name, Marlo?
No, my name is Sidney Jenkins.
Come on, let's go inside, Marlo. We want to talk to you.
Oh, is this where I'm supposed to say, what is all this about? And he says, shut up, I asked the question.
Yeah, that's right.
And it happens every day.
Right profile.
Sit down. What the hell are you doing? Yeah, that's right.
I'm going to read this thing, Swanee. How I love you, how are you?
When some passerby invites your eye to come.
And I think, although this has nothing to do with the plot, I think what you're seeing here, what it establishes, is that in this movie, you know, Marlo, this great detective, this great private eye, you know, he can't even find the right kind of cat food for his cat. I think it sort of it sets the tone for this sort of deflated vision of what this guy is and his place in the world. And I think even though it's sort of this strange, almost non sequitur beginning, it's really kind of brilliant.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but I love this movie. It's one of my favorite Altman movies. So kind of quirky and fun and strange, and has a wonderful theme song, which is played like dozens of times in the movie. It's the Muzak in the supermarket. It's the song on the radio. Yeah, people like whistle it, or it's played on a piano in a bar by a, you know, piano man. It's the long goodbye theme, and it just kind of floats through the movie and connects all these different spaces in this really interesting way. And of course, Elliot Gould, who I love, again, just an unlikely Marlo, but just amazing in the movie, just almost like a jazz musician kind of performance. Like, it feels very improvised. He's like mumbly and rambling, and you know, it's like no Philip Marlowe you've ever seen before until you've seen The Long Goodbye, I guess. So that's The Long Goodbye, the great Robert Altman film, playing on Netflix Instant. And I guess one last thing to mention is the fact that this movie, not only is it not sort of a quote-unquote faithful adaptation, it sort of is addressing the idea of that, right? I mean, it's very much a movie about taking something out of its, like, natural habitat, not just the book setting, but also, like, the time, this particular time and place, and seeing what happens when you transpose that into a very different time and place, and seeing what happens, which is really interesting.
It's a great movie, and I have read that novel.
That was the one I had read too, but not in a long time.
Yeah, and it's probably my favorite of the Marlowe. It's one of my favorite novels.
The Big Sleep is good too.
Yeah, but it is actually an adaptation I like a lot, because in a weird way it reflects how internal the novels are. They're all first person.
Right.
And he's such a solitary character that you sometimes wonder what he looks like from the outside. You never see that.
Mm.
And so to have that be this kind of, almost, like, not disappointing, but being so different from how he represents himself inside, I really liked.
That's interesting. So, like, from the inside, he's this great private eye. He sees himself that way. But the movie has a slightly more judgmental view.
Yes. All right, so my pick is very different, and it's one actually I'm glad I got a chance to see through this, which is Hellraiser, the 1987 horror film, written and directed by Clive Barker and based on his own 1986 novella, The Hellbound Heart.
Hellraiser, beyond any terror you have imagined. Unlike anything you have witnessed, is born. Because within these walls, the unholy is unleashed.
And this is a property that I'm sure as everyone, even if you haven't seen this movie, was familiar with through Pinhead, the character of Pinhead.
Sure.
And this, you know, very iconic looking character wearing vinyl with the pins, and had this vague idea of what it was about involving a puzzle box.
Yeah, I have no idea. Yes. I've actually never seen it either. All I know is that striking figure on VHS box art.
Right.
Looking at me and wondering, what is this movie about? I have no idea, but please tell me.
Well, I will tell you, Matt. It's about, they are this race of demons, basically, that exist in their own dimension. But they're actually not the focus. The focus is on this character named Frank Cotton, who is a sadomasochist. He's devoted his life to just, in a very objectivist way, to the selfish pursuit of pleasures. And to the point where he comes across, he hears about this puzzle box that, you know, will allow him this ultimate, to open this, you know, the path to this ultimate experience.
Okay.
And what it turns out to be is a doorway to this dimension in which these creatures are devoted to basically such extreme sensations that pain, horrible pain, is the equivalent to like they're indistinguishable.
Right.
So he thinks he's in for like this great, you know, sensory experience.
He's looking for like the ultimate spring break.
Yeah.
And he winds up in like the ultimate hostel, essentially.
Yeah, they tear him apart with hooks. Yeah. In the attic.
Okay.
And that's the introduction. So actually, while there is a monster in this story, the monster is actually Frank, that he, like, the part of him kind of lingers in the house while I think it's his brother moves in, and his the brother's wife, who's always fixated, had an affair with Frank and was fixated on him. And he I don't want to go through all of this, but basically finds a way to start kind of building himself back by using by murdering other people. So he is the monster. Pinhead is like a kind of framing character who returns.
The misunderstood beaten.
No, though I would say that what's interesting, and I would guess what's part of the appeal of this character, mm-hmm. is that he's not evil necessarily, like just has his own kind of amoral agenda.
Right.
Is not actually out to, you know, and it's a deal, right?
Yeah.
You open the puzzle box, you get this. You had to seek it out. Even if you didn't know what you were fully getting into, you know, he's not looking to take over the world, mm-hmm. or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
This is just what he does.
Okay.
This weird hook, you know, mangling thing. That's just it. That's his hobby.
That's
okay?
His thing, man.
Yeah.
We've all got things.
Exactly. So that was interesting. And, I, you know, I'm sure as this, as the franchise goes on, he gets put more, like, you learn way too much about the character.
Right.
As
there's a backstory is filled,
yes,
in.
Yes, exactly. And he,
yes.
you know, whatever.
He probably was abused as a child.
I'm sure he falls in love.
But, that was Hellraiser 3.
Yeah. But this, I thought, I mean, not everything holds together well, particularly the haircuts, which are prime mid-80s, but I think there is some interesting imagery in here, and just it's so kind of unusual in its approach to that kind of character, which I've never seen before. So that's Hellraiser. It's on Netflix Instant, and it's there until November 30th, 2014. So you've got some time.
All right. So my next book to film adaptation, this one I have not read. I would wager, although I hope some people have seen the movie, very few of our listeners have ever read as well. It's the 1973 film Charlie Varick, directed by Don Siegel, written by Dean Reisner and Howard Rodman, from the novel The Looters by John H. Rhys. And Allison, I know you weren't familiar with this one.
No.
Oh, man. This is a great little obscure gem from Don Siegel, who's the director of many great films like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and Dirty Harry. This one stars, much like those other films, a great action hero of the cinema, Walter Matthau. Walter Matthau is your star and your action hero in this case. He plays Charlie Varick, who is, quote-unquote, the last of the independents. And it's I don't want to get too much into the plot, but it's basically a story involving bank robbery and running from the law. And what's interesting is not just the fantastic, very lean direction by Don Siegel, who is such a great director of these kind of thrillers, but this idea that this character, who part of his sort of the way he escapes the cops is his sort of disguise as a crop duster, Charlie Varick, the last of the independents. And this is one of those movies where it's not really about movies in terms of on the screen, but when somebody's walking around with a sign on their back that says the last of the independents, you start to assign things about it, about movies or about artistry or about just personal philosophy. So the fact that he is the quote-unquote last of the independents, I think, adds a very interesting texture. And if you're a big Walter Matthau fan, which I am, it is great to see him in this role. It's kind of like the Elliot Gould thing, where for some reason in the 1970s, it was permissible for action movies to be about, like, nebbishy Jewish guys, which is so awesome.
Half a million?
Could be.
Harold Young, Trace Cruz's bank manager, has estimated that the bandits escaped with less than $2,000.
Who are they kidding, us?
It's 10-1. This stuff belongs to the mafia. This is gambling money skimmed off the top. The mafia kills you. No trial, no judge. They never stop looking for you, not till you're dead. I'd rather have 10 FBIs after me.
One man against the mafia.
Bang! This little bank a million miles from nowhere gets hit by four professionals. Now they're going to think that's strange.
Why couldn't it be just a coincidence?
Because they don't believe in coincidence.
Yeah, it's pretty great, actually.
And he is really good in this movie. It is not like anything else you've seen him in, unless you've seen one of the other couple of movies he made or in this period, including the original Taking a Pelham 1-2-3, where he was also sort of the star. That one's a little less action-y.
Right.
It's a lot of him sitting around talking. But he's still like sort of the cop in that, so that's somewhat similar. There's another movie he made around this time, a little after it, called Hopscotch, which is like a spy, traveling spy movie that's also kind of fun. But Charlie Varick, if you've never seen it, this is one, like, when I used to work at Kim's, the video store, and people would come in saying, like, what's a good, like, action movie or heist movie that I've never heard of? This is one that the clerks would often recommend because it's just really good, and very few people have seen it. So Charlie Varick, it's on Netflix Instant. Walter Matthau forever.
All right, I will add it to my queue.
Excellent.
All right, my next pick is Fish Story. It's a Japanese film directed by Yoshihiro Nakamura and based on a novel by Kotaro Isaka, which I don't know if that's translated. So I don't know if I even could read it if I wanted to. But this is a really kind of great little film about how a proto-punk song recorded by this forgotten Japanese band in 1975 ends up saving the world in 2012 when it's about to be hit by a comet. So this film jumps through eras and brings through these improbable connections dealing with how this song kind of led to one thing that led to another that led to another, has these often kind of funny, weirdly touching little stories within it, including one, like the one that the results in the title, Fish Story, that comes from the fact that there was a man who was looking for work in the post-war years when he had to support his family. And basically he lied to a publisher who thought he was a foreigner, saying that he spoke English. And he took on the translation of this book and he just used a dictionary and did a word for word translation because he didn't speak a word of English. And so he gets it's the title is Fish Story of the book. And that's supposed to be like a big fish story, right? Like an exaggerated tale.
Ah.
But instead, he thinks that the book is about a fish.
It's literally about a fish.
Yeah. And so that's why. And so like it becomes like this artifact and that leads to the song and so on. And so it's got a slightly awkward setup in that it jumps back and forth between these eras and you don't even see the whole kind of scenario unfold in each era before jumping away. And you jump to the present, which is with like three people hanging out at a record store waiting for the world to end, basically, mm-hmm. and bickering.
発売当時、誰にも聞かれなかった曲, Fish Story,が世界を救う.
Fish Story? Fish Story?
Fish Story.
Funny and also very weirdly sweet from this band that knows they're not going anywhere getting to record this one song to a guy who's been trained all his life to be a champion of justice, and there gets to be this great action scene on a ferry, and how it all comes together is put together at the end, and it's very funny and very unusual. And I think that actually in some ways the fact that it's based on a novel comes through in a good way, in that it's got this unwieldy structure that kind of throws off any expectations you could have about how things will fit together. So it's a really great film. I'm a big fan. It's Fish Story on Netflix Instant, and that's there until October 2013.
Okay, well, I'm going to cheat with my last pick because I'm not
doing about
a...
this.
Yeah, I know. I'm not going to do a book to film. I am going to do a book to television show. Although this book was turned into a film as well. All three have the same title. Friday Night Lights, developed for television by Peter Berg, who actually also directed the movie version of Friday Night Lights, based on the 1990 book by Buzz Bissinger. The show premiered in 2006. It ran for 5 seasons. And I wanted to talk about it because I'm sort of midway through it, more than midway through it right now. I'm watching it right now, little by little, any chance I get. I'm up to season 4 right now. And it's just an amazing show. It's one of the few sort of broadcast shows I've seen that feels like it comes close to approximating kind of the intelligence, the pleasures, and complexity of The Wire, which to me is like the best show ever made. And like The Wire, it's kind of more about a community and how that community functions and interrelates than it is about any one particular character. In fact, because it's about a high school and a high school football team, the players kind of come and go, although maybe some linger around more than they actually should, but new ones come in, you know, and it's more about the team and the way the team affects this small town in Texas named Dillon, and how everything in the town revolves around the football team and how the football team comes to sort of represent the identity of the town and what happens when the team does well and also what happens when the team does badly.
Gentlemen, there's been a lot of talk about expectation lately. Expectation of what we should be able to do to win. People are expecting. People are expecting quite a bit. I see us winning out there tonight. I have no trouble seeing that. That is not what I'm expecting. I expect you boys to go out there and not take this team lightly, because I promise you, they're going to come at you with everything they've got. I expect you boys to execute.
Yes, sir.
Expect you boys to play football.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose.
And I think even though I've seen the movie as well, the movie's fine. The movie is good, but the TV show is better because the project was just better suited to television. You know, the original book by Buzz Bissinger, which I haven't read. I mean, to do the book, he went and lived in this little town in Texas for a year and just embedded himself with the team and then wrote the book. So to really get at what he was doing, where you're telling this whole story about this whole team, all the different characters, the coach, the players, the boosters, you need kind of that much space. If you were going to make it a film, you'd have to make like a 22-hour film. So you cut those 22 hours into 22 parts, you put it on television, you call it Friday Night Lights. And that's basically what happens in the first season, essentially. The movie was more faithful to the historical record of what actually happened in this town. But I think the TV show does a better job of getting at sort of the emotional realism or the emotional truth of what happens in towns like this. The characters are different, the stories are a little different, but you get a better sense of all the different sides of what happens from, you know, like players who think that they're going to become future NFL stars and have their careers cut short by injuries, to players who think that they have no future because they're kind of dopey and dumb, but they're great football players. And
that's their moment.
This is their moment to shine, but let's not worry about the future. To the coach whose whole kind of career lives or dies every single week on whether or not he can win the next game. So there's all this crazy pressure. It is a great show. Allison, I know you've started it. You watched
The first season and a half, I'm at. Yeah. Okay. And
season of the show is notoriously the worst season.
There are
some episodes of the second season that are bad.
Yeah.
But there's also some very good episodes of the second season, and it regained its footing pretty quickly. So by the end of the second season, it's a pretty good show again already. The other problem with the second season, besides the fact that there are some wonky storylines that they sort of shoehorned
network
in
notes
that,
kind
yeah,
of
that, yeah, network notes kind of storylines, that season was also cut short by the writer's strike. So it was sort of left dangling. There's no resolution to the second season. So when the third season picks up, they don't continue. They sort of carry on as if the second season kind of finished, but we never saw it.
Interesting.
Which is, I guess, a sort of a choice you had to make, but I don't know if it completely works. But The third season is great. The fourth season, which I haven't finished yet, is even better. I'm looking forward to finishing it, finishing the fifth season. It is a great, great show. Oh, man, I'm loving every minute of it. I really recommend people check it out. It's long. I mean, it's a lot of a show to get through, but it's well worth it. Friday Night Lights, available on Netflix Instant.
Yeah, and that's also one, you didn't mention the visuals, but it is shot in this very beautiful kind of loose way and has some great moments, a great feel for like Americana in a non, it doesn't feel like it's too staged.
You're absolutely right. Like, for a broadcast TV show, it looks really, really good. The production values are high. And yeah, the scripts, although the shows are really well written, and the main relationship between the coach and his wife is really one of the best marriages I've ever seen on television. It's also not too tightly scripted. They let the actors kind of play with the dialogue. There's a lot of improvisation, and the camera work reflects that. You know, there's a lot of loose camera work where they're just sort of following people and trying to capture these moments. And it's really well shot. It's a beautiful show.
Yeah. All right. Well, my final pick is not at all like Friday Night Lights. It is Walkabout, 1971 film directed by Nicholas Roeg, who directed our last episode's listener's choice pick, The Man Who Fell to Earth. And this is based on the novel Walkabout by James Vance Marshall, which I have not read, but I'm actually very curious about. This is a film about a teenage girl and her quite a bit younger brother who are brought into the outback to have a picnic by their father. And, you know, having a picnic never bodes well in an Australian movie. I feel like it just always leads to doom and disaster. But for reasons that aren't quite clear, he snaps. He starts shooting at his children and then sets their car on fire and commits suicide. And they are stranded out in the wilderness, and they are, you know, they're extremely urban children. The film does this amazing job of showing the immense divide. It starts off in like city life, and then just how different, while in the same country, you know, like really a drive away, how different and kind of almost Eden-like the outback can be. Mm-hmm. But it's also, you know, they have no idea how to survive, and they're very, like, proper children. And the girl also tries to shield her brother from this really awful thing that happens. Mm-hmm. So they meet this Aboriginal boy, and he helps them, even though he doesn't speak English.
There is a place where time stands still, where nature is harsh and demanding, where only the quick and the strong and the deadly can survive. This place is no place for civilized man. In this place, man is just another of God's creatures.
And the film just has this amazing representation of the outback and of nature, and the way it kind of stops to observe wildlife is something else. And also just the way it's like this almost dreamlike setting. Things happen like they find this like oasis that has a fruit tree by it, and they stop overnight and they drink water and they've been parched and they bathe and they sleep, and then they wake up the next morning and it's dried out. And there's something just almost surreal about how that works. Mm-hmm. But it the whole film has this dreamlike quality to it. It's pretty amazing. And also in the way it treats the relationship between the two of them and the boy, their guide. And it doesn't end. It ends in tragedy. It just in terms of visuals, pretty remarkable. And definitely very different from The Man Who Fell to Earth in tone, as much like they both have this very surreal undertone to them, but this one seems much more sensory in all of it, like just how it represents sound, how it represents just these like little, you know, like a insect crawling on the ground. So anyway, that is on Hulu Plus, and that is courtesy of the Criterion Collection.
Midas Mulligan.
Who's asking?
Someone who knows what it's like to work for himself and not let others feed off the profits of his energy.
Who are you?
We found a note.
What did it say?
It said, who is John Galt?
One of the worst railroad accidents in recent history.
A Taggart transcontinental freight train has crashed and derailed
I have to get the Rio Norte completely rerailed in 9 months, and I'm gambling your new metal can do what you say it can.
I'm staking my business on it.
Nobody's used Reardon metal. Why do we have to be the first?
Well, they say you're intractable, you're ruthless, your only goal is to make money.
My only goal is to make money.
Yeah, but you shouldn't say it.
If we're going to bring Reardon down, we should do it from the inside.
Mark your calendars, film spotters. September 2nd, 2016. That's the date, according to Atlas Shrugged Part 1, when everything changes. The Middle East implodes. Gas skyrockets to $37 a gallon. Hugely influential CEOs begin vanishing. The government begins imposing illogical restrictions on businesses, hurting their ability to make limitless profits, and people suddenly start having weird names like Dagny Taggart, Wesley Mouch, and Ragnar the Pirate. These are dark times indeed. Thankfully, in this dark dystopia of 4 years from now, there are a few who stand against the evil of governmental oversight and altruism. Women like Dagny Taggart, the vice president of Taggart Transcontinental Railroad, who forms an alliance with another hero, Hank Reardon, the CEO of Reardon Steel Company. God, these names are hard to say, Allison. Together, they build a new railroad using Reardon's remarkable and remarkably narcissistically named Reardon Metal. Despite interference from evil government agencies and rival corporations. Now, Allison, Atlas Shrugged Part 1, which was our listener's pick this week over the yes. cult sci-fi TV miniseries World on a Wire and the new comedy Goon.
Right. This is all your fault, listeners.
It's all your fault. Thank you so much. Is based on the famous 1957 novel by Ayn Rand, who used the book to outline her personal philosophy, which she called objectivism. Or rather, it's based on part of Rand's famous 1957 novel. As the title indicates, director Paul Johansson's 95-minute film only covers maybe the first third or so of the book. So, my first question to you, Allison, is this. Was splitting Atlas Shrugged into multiple films, Breaking Dawn style, a good idea? My second question is this. Is the movie as bad as its reputation, which it earned on the strength or perhaps the weakness of terrible reviews and several citations as the worst film of last year? Is it as bad as all that? And last, but not least, the most important question, the question that has plagued men's minds for over half a century. Who is John Galt?
Well, why don't I take that last one first?
Please.
It's director Paul Johansson.
Oh, who, spoiler alert.
Who plays John Galt, who you only see in silhouettes coming away to...
Yeah, he's like a bad X-Files villain.
He is. He arrives to offer... the dialogue just rolls off your tongue. I'm simply offering society that cultivates individual achievement, he offers to all of these CEOs, mm-hmm. who then go missing, mysteriously vanish. So there you go. That's who John Galt is.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for clearing that one up.
It's a good thing that the director cast himself in the heroic role. in terms of whether it was a good idea to split this film up, I don't know that it would be better if it were all the book in one extra long movie, but certainly this does not end on any kind of, you know, accelerated note, really. It ends just kind of abruptly with a character who we didn't have that much attachment to begin with, becoming one of the missing as well. And that's it, you know? I really, to be honest, I couldn't really remember like what the status was of the railroad at this point that they were trying to build. I couldn't remember I have no idea why I would be driven to watch the second part. Then again, I have no idea why I would be driven to watch the first part, not being, a diehard...
Randian. Yeah.
Objectivist in my lifestyle choices.
Right. No, I recognize that the original novel is very long, which perhaps suggested the idea of splitting it up, but the movie is only an hour and a half, and nothing happens in
nothing
it.
Nothing happens
at it's
all.
It's all set up. So it's like when you say you're making Atlas Shrugged Part 1, what you're really saying is you're making Atlas Shrugged Act 1. And right. Who wants to just see the first act of a story with no guarantee of seeing those other parts?
Right. And it should be said that this is a story of railroad... fighting railroad monopolies.
Yes.
Like this, that is literally what the dramatic situation is here. Like, yes. There's almost nothing that can be done to make it into something exciting, and certainly not the way this is written.
Characters expouse
philosophy, basically.
Yeah. It's a series of scenes where characters sit in offices and in like expensive looking cocktail lounges discussing metallurgy and monopolies of railroads
and government regulation.
And government regulation.
Like, your friends in the government, get your friends in the government to get me the approvals that I need. That Dagny Taggart has a brother who basically is there to serve as like both a representation of everything she is not, but mm-hmm. also to be like cowardly, to take credit for all of her hard work, to be whiny about her.
Right.
Like basically just there to serve as a foil for all the things that she, at least through the eyes of the book
right.
and the film, is doing right.
I understand that this is all Ayn Rand's philosophy, but I have to say I did get a kick out of, and I know that you're supposed to buy into it, I suppose, but I did get a kick out of certain scenes where characters say things like, why all these stupid altruistic urges? It's not being charitable or fair. What is it with people today? And in another movie, that would be something the villain says to sort of show how greedy and evil they are. And in this movie, that's something Dagny says. That is the heroic attitude in this film. Like, literally, she's complaining that people are altruistic. Not just, the government is trying to regulate things. That people are altruistic and charitable. That's a bad thing in this
right.
movie,
or
which
they,
I sort of get a kick out of.
It is funny. And also that they want, like, safety regulations. I like that, one of the major – the reasoning behind her partnership with Reardon Metal is that she knows it's a good product.
Right.
No one's ever used it before.
Right.
This is based on his own studies.
Yes.
Right? Not, like, any kind of outside study. But she's like, this is a great product. I'm going to build my whole railroad out of this.
Yes.
I don't care what people say.
I'm going to build this new bridge.
Yes.
With this metal, and if it's not as good as he says it is, people could die,
right.
things could be destroyed, but I don't care.
Right, exactly. Like, this, that is one of the funniest parts to me, is just, like, why does she know? She's like, well, I went to engineering school or something like that.
Right.
And therefore she's ready to commit to this.
It's basically, and whether or not, I'm sure we're going to get maybe some people who email and say, I completely, I'm wrong and I'm a horrible person. But basically, it's a justification for greed, is it not?
Oh,
isn't
it,
that
well,
what
selfishness? It's like rational selfishness is part of objectivism.
Right.
Yeah. Acting in your own self-interest.
Right. Being greedy encourages people to succeed. That's basically what it is.
Yeah. If you want, I can have the quote from her, which is, my philosophy, in essence, is the concept of man as a heroic being, something that's brought up in
yes.
this film.
Yes.
With his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life, with productive achievement as his noblest activity, and reason as his only absolute. So, yes, pursuit of your own happiness, regardless of how it affects other people,
right?
Is an important part of this. The idea that you would ever kind of do something, put your own needs below other people's,
is outrageous.
It will lead to the destruction of the world.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I do like that the movie and this philosophy is all about the power and the greatness of the free market, right? And the proof that the free market works is in the failure of the movie, that the movie was a huge flop because it's terrible. So there you go. Maybe Ayn Rand was right all along. Was there anything at all that you actually liked about the movie?
Well, just the fact that it was so weird, like the fact that it
is pretty weird
about railroad, like that it skips straight into like being like, of course, now we just all started building railroads again.
Mm-hmm.
Its ideas about the U.S. are... They reminded me a little bit about, Kafka wrote a book about America, but he never went to America, so he
mm-hmm.
just read a lot of brochures about
right.
it and then wrote
this
very weird, warped version.
Or like Lars von Trier making Dogville
yeah,
when he
exactly.
was never been to America.
Like, I mean, that's not the case with Ayn Rand, but that you do get this feeling, it's idea of America, because also that, like, it's set in all of these, I am presuming for budget reasons, like kind of underpopulated looking. Whenever they're somewhere inside,
yeah.
it often looks very underpopulated.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the movie, when they're outside, is all in like small towns in the Midwest. They're always going from like Cheyenne to somewhere like outside in the middle of Colorado.
Yeah.
They spend like the entire middle to end part of the movie driving around, the Midwest and like north.
Despite those $37 a gallon
yes,
gas prices, they're driving all over the place.
Exactly. They're taking a road trip.
But they're huge CEOs, so they have lots of money.
So that's totally fine.
It's not a problem.
Yeah. So one of the reasons that I've not read the novel, but I would like to see part two, if it ever went to Atlantis, this mythical place that everyone is running away to. I mean,
right.
the idea also, they say that the idea is that all of these men are being wooed away to this new...
By John Galt,
to this new world. Also, to go on strike.
They're going on strike.
Right? But it's also, it's half we're going on strike and half just like, we're going to run away and then you're going to miss us. Like,
right.
Kind of attitude.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, what is this place like, this ideal paradise that's apparently only peopled by middle-aged white CEOs, right? Like, who just like... Do they do their own cooking now and cleaning? Like, they're all like, do they know how to do these things?
You know?
Like, this is like the great, like, new
society.
It
sounds like a setting for a Funny or Die sketch when you put it that way. I will say, I mean, some of those vistas and those places you described are kind of spectacular.
Yeah.
And I will say the movie has this rare quality where it looks both very expensive and very cheap, which is rare and almost kind of impressive in a weird way, because it looks like they spent a lot of money on parts of it, and then there's other parts that look just so flat out cheap. You know, like, they have these incredible shots of America. They clearly went on location for some of these shots. They got, you know, these nice, and then the scenes of like boardrooms, some of them look like the cheapest sets you've ever seen. Like, CEOs of huge corporations, they basically like work out of a wood paneled closet, basically. They're these tiny little sets, you know. It has this weird quality of both cheap and expensive at the same time. I don't know if I've ever seen that in another movie before.
Yeah, it is weird. There is no real equivalent for this. So did you feel like any of these characters resembled characters at all?
You mean like human beings?
Yes.
Like actual human beings? No, not at all. And in fact, one of the notes I had was that the lead actress, Taylor Schilling, who has a career. I mean,
yeah,
she's
no,
not...
I mean, I've seen her in things that I've liked. She was in that show Mercy that mm-hmm. was about nurses and seemed very Nurse Jackie-ish.
And she is going to be the star, I think, of the upcoming, like the next Nicholas Sparks adaptation. The Lucky One. I think she's the female love interest in that. So she's a legitimate actress. But in this movie, I wrote in my notes, it sounds like she's doing an impression of Siri. Like, it sounds like she's speaking robotically almost on purpose. Like, she's supposed to be cold and dispassionate, almost to an extreme of ludicrousness. She sounds a little like the phone voice. She sounds like a automaton.
Yeah, I did like that she, like her, in contrast to Reardon's wife, who he's married to this woman and she has these friends around and they all basically just mock him to his face. They're basically like, he gives her a present that's a bracelet made of his Reardon medal, right?
It's one of a kind.
It's very important to her. And everyone is basically like, in front of him. They're like,
he invented a medal and then gave you a bracelet made out of it?
And
lame.
And then immediately after that, the guy is like, I need money for my charity, but like, can you wire it? It'd be embarrassing for us to have your name on the charity, you know? It's like, it's the weirdest representation of like having people be altruistic but also evil.
Yes,
that, like, it's just such
how,
an
yeah,
odd
how do
way
you make yeah how do
to,
you make
to try and make that happen.
Yeah, how do you make altruism
funny.
Evil? That's yeah. how I do it. Well, will we see part two? I tend to doubt it.
Well, I don't see how anyone could how it could be financially viable to make a part two.
God, I'd kind of want to.
I kind of do too.
It was kind of fun to watch it because it's like from something out of the Bizarro universe.
Yeah,
or something.
Let's start a Kickstarter campaign for them.
Ooh. Wait a second, we can't do that. Kickstarter, that's the exact opposite of what Ayn Rand would believe. She wouldn't accept the money because
it's
socialism. That's crowdsourcing. That's the mask.
No,
giving.
We selfishly want to see a part two,
God,
and therefore we can make this happen.
So complicated. All right, well, that's Atlas Shrugged Part 1, and it is available on Netflix. Watch instantly.
We close out the show with Behind the Eight Ball, where we give you quick picks for new and expiring titles. These are all on Netflix Instant this time. We're going to start with the expiring titles. My first pick is The Gates, which is expiring on April 12th. That is directed by Antonio Ferrara and Albert Maysles, the great documentarian. And it's about Christo and Jean-Claude, the artists who wrap things. They do these giant public installations. And it's about The Gates, which is the name of the one they did in Central Park. It was New York City's biggest public art project ever. And it was this really beautiful, striking thing.
It was amazing.
Yeah, with gates that went through the park with like orange. And it's worth seeing if you weren't able to be in New York when they had it up. It's worth seeing in the film just because it was very beautiful.
Mm. Almost as beautiful as The Gates was as an art project. My expiring title, which is expiring on April 16th, is the beautiful and majestic Gamer. from the beautiful and majestic directors Neville Dean and Taylor. It stars Gerard Butler and Michael C. Hall. I'm a big fan of Neville Dean and Taylor. This is not one of their very best movies, but it is an interesting one nonetheless. It is about a dystopian future, much like the world of Atlas Shrugged Part 1.
Where, more interesting, fortunately.
Yeah, actually, it probably is more interesting. It is about a world where basically... it's a fight to the death movie, much like The Hunger Games as well, I suppose, in which gamers control these real-life people who are involved in basically a real-life video game, first-person shooter style. I don't think we've seen yet the definitive movie about sort of first-person shooters in video games. Certainly, there have been a lot of attempts, most of them pretty terrible. This one is one of the more interesting ones. I don't know if it gets all the way there. But it is an interesting movie with some great cinematography, as Neville Dean and Taylor always have, some interesting ideas, and one really marvelous action/musical number towards the end of the film, which is really one of the best kind of just take that scene out of the movie. That scene, that sequence alone, is really kind of one of the coolest things I've seen in a movie in a long time. So that's Gamer. Available until April 16th.
All right, and my last pick is The Cruise from 1998, and that is expiring on April 13th. That is it's a documentary, kind of a cult favorite, about unlicensed tour guide Timothy Speed Levitch. And the film is really, it's a portrait of him, and it's also just a portrait of his incredible spiel that he gives about, like, he just tells these odd, interesting anecdotes about the city, and is just a great talker. And so he's one of those people that you do really want to spend time with, and you can see why his ridiculous tours are actually so popular. And this was directed by Bennett Miller, who then went on to direct Capote and then Moneyball. Mm. And actually, Richard Linklater is doing a web series on Hulu that hasn't come out yet, but that is also based around Timothy Speed Levitch. Huh. It's called Up to Speed. So that's one to look out for as well. Obviously, he was in Waking Life as well. Obviously, right. He has a cinematic appeal.
That's right. So before this one disappears, you should check it out, because you're going to want to see it before this new web series comes
out.
It's so like that's a prereq.
So that's The Cruise, and that's expiring on April 13th.
Okay, and very quickly, some new movies to Netflix and other services. This first one is actually not on Netflix. This is on VOD, iTunes, that sort of thing. And it is one of the movies we were going to discuss potentially as a listener's choice pick this week. It's Goon. I had to review it for a website that I've started writing for, a brand new website called Screen Crush, which I will plug, screencrush.com. They assigned me to review it, so I had to see it anyway, despite over listeners' objections, I guess. But it's actually a really great movie. It's really entertaining. It is a hockey comedy. It's about a minor league hockey team. And this guy, Doug Glott, if you know Judaism, you know Hebrew at all, Glott is a word for kosher, which suggests, I think, in some ways, the purity of his spirit, even though he is a goon and he is a thug on the ice. His job is to beat up people on the ice. He's a very kind-hearted soul. Although it is a hockey comedy, and that minor league hockey comedy at that, and that sort of connects it to Slapshot, the classic, the ultimate minor league hockey movie of all time. It actually, the movie has a lot in common with sort of a comedic version of Rocky. He's sort of this gentle, brutal guy, basically, and he has this relationship with this unlikely relationship with this woman who's played in the movie by Alison Pill, who's really funny and cute and charming and is probably going to win over a lot of filmgoers' hearts with this role. And it's about his trials and tribulations and about the world of hockey, which is treated very sincerely, even though it's a comedy. Like the teamwork and the way that the guys all come together for this goal becomes sort of this kind of inspiring thing. So Goon, I actually would recommend it. It's a fun movie. It is available now on VOD and iTunes.
All right. Well, my pick is it's new on Netflix Instant, and it is Burma Vijay from Anders Ostergaard. It is a Danish documentary, but it is about Burma. And it's about, VJ stands for video journalists, and it's illegal to film things on the street there. But there are a lot of people who will surreptitiously film, and then their footage is shipped away to Scandinavia, where it's broadcast back to the country as a kind of the only, you know, a non-government controlled feed of information. So you literally risk your life doing this, being seen with cameras. And the film is primarily footage that's shot on these handheld cameras and put together with a few kind of reconstructed sequences that are primarily about like the narrator, who is another video journalist, talking about having to leave the country. I just think an amazing film. The footage is incredible, but it's also put together in this very moving way because it captures the 2007 protests when all of these people are out on the streets and it really looks like there's a potential for change. So that's Burma Vijay on Netflix Instant Watch. Watch instantly.
Okay, our third choice this week, this is also on Netflix, is called Killing Bono, I believe from 2011, directed by Nick Hamm. This is based on a true story. Obviously, the person didn't actually kill Bono because, as you are probably aware, spoiler alert, Bono is still alive. But it's about these childhood friends of Bono back before he was Bono, who were in a band. They were sort of like circling around U2 before it was U2. And then U2 took off, became one of the biggest rock bands in the world. And the narrator and his brother, who were almost in the band, the brother actually was in the band very briefly or auditioning for the band, and the brother kind of talked him out of it. Their band sort of never takes off. So it sounds kind of dark, I guess, or depressing, especially the title. The title maybe isn't the best title in the world for what the movie is. But it is kind of a absurdist comedy about what it feels like to be left in the dust, essentially, to be the guy who was almost Bono, what it must feel like to be the guy who like sat next to Bono in class and you both dreamed of becoming rock stars together and he actually did it and you didn't. You know, it's about like how it feels to be so close to your dream that you can like taste it, but not close enough to actually enjoy it. That's basically the thrust of the movie. And it's well made. It's funny. It's charming. And it has sort of some interesting themes to it, I thought.
Yeah, and is actually very generous to Bono. Bono comes across as a very nice, down-to-earth guy.
That's right. It doesn't paint Bono in an unflattering light. It paints the guy who wants to, quote-unquote, kill Bono in an unflattering light, who's the guy who wrote the book that it's based on. So it's sort of a, you know, it plays it in all the right ways. So that's Killing Bono. That's also available on Netflix. And one thing we want to start doing with this new reconfigured Behind the Eight Ball that we're doing here is we want to include a listener recommendation for something listeners are watching on Netflix or whatever else they're watching this week. So this week's recommendation comes from Mike Merrigan in Dover, New Hampshire. He says, Allison and Matt, right now I'm really enjoying getting caught up with a TV show called Sports Night. Was created and written by Aaron Sorkin and produced by Ron Howard and Brian Grazer. It's Sorkin's first foray with walk and talk TV that he would later perfect in The West Wing. And I would add, he even greater perfected in the immortal classic Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. Are you with me, Allison?
No, I am not.
All right, very well. Sports Night, Mike goes on, follows the cast and crew of an upstart ESPN-style TV show and the daily trials of broadcast television. Think 30 Rock, but replace the absurdity with Sorkin's signature quick and clever banter. The sharp dialogue is delivered by the likes of Felicity Huffman, Peter Krause, and William H. Macy. It's silly, serious, and smart. Enjoy it. I have enjoyed it. I love Sports Night. It's a great show. Have you ever watched it, Allison?
I have watched it. Yeah. And it is very enjoyable. It's so Aaron Sorkin, though. It's funny to be like, it's almost like his voice comes through stronger through all of the characters in this one. And then he learned to kind of diversify it more the more he's written in TV shows.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's a really fun show. So thank you for that recommendation, Mike. If you have a recommendation, what you're watching, you want to send out to listeners, you can email us feedback@filmspottingsvu.com.
Okay, and now it's time for our listener's choice section, in which we present three choices for you for which film we're going to talk about next week, and you tell us which one it should be with your votes. All right, the first pick is an instant classic, really.
Absolutely.
Ahead of its time. It's Human Centipede 2, which is coming to Netflix, and this is Tom Six's, sequel.
Masterpiece.
Expansion.
The word you're looking for
masterpiece.
Is masterpiece.
Follow-up.
It's literally a literal expansion.
To the Human Centipede first sequence. And this is a film. I have not seen this yet. I know that you have, Matt.
I saw it at Fantastic Fest.
This is not a film that went over so well with many of the fans of the original.
No, it was not accepted by all of the fans.
But it's a film about someone who is an obsessive fan of the first film.
Correct. Perhaps a reason why the fans of the first film did not embrace it, because this portrait of this fan...
Not so flattering. Yeah. All right. So that's Human Centipede 2.
Okay. Option number 2 this week is very similar, I think, thematically and visually as well. It's black and white, I guess. Is Ace in the Hole, the 1951 film starring Kirk Douglas and directed by Billy Wilder. This is a very famous example of sort of the earliest critique, I would say, of like the shape of the media world to come. A lot of people point to this as one of the earliest sort of films that anticipated where we are now in terms of reality television and this weird media saturation that we live with every day. It's about a journalist who gets wrapped up in this this story and sort of is kind of a almost has a sort of like Carnival Barker-esque role in hyping up the story to make it bigger and bigger, and what happens to him and to the people involved in the story as it takes on this larger than life status. I have seen it. It's been probably a decade since I saw it, Allison. What about you?
Have
you
seen it? I have not seen it, and I've been wanting to.
Yeah,
so.
It's a great movie. It's kind of one of those movies that, you know, it's considered a classic by people who have seen it, but it's not all that widely seen. So it seems like a good one to catch up with, revisit if you haven't seen it. Looking forward to seeing it again if this one wins. So that's Ace in the Hole, and that's I believe that's also on Netflix.
Yeah, I think all three of these are
all
on
three
Netflix
of these are on
time,
Netflix this week, yeah.
Including this third pick, which is a TV series.
Mm.
It is Lights Out, which was an FX series from last year. It ran one season, did not get picked up for a second season. It was pretty well received critically,
yeah.
Though. It just didn't catch on audience-wise.
Yeah.
Same with Terriers, which is
FX,
I loved.
Yeah, and, FX has a history of those one and done, critically
right.
acclaimed, but they didn't quite catch on.
Yeah, but they've been doing some interesting programming there. So
yeah.
Definitely one that's why we're interested in this one. It stars Holt McElhaney as Patrick Lights Leary, who is a former world heavyweight champion, but is older now. He's got a lot of wear and tear on him. He's trying to support his family. They live in New Jersey, and he's kind of trying to choose between these two paths of either becoming a debt collector, basically. A kind of shady debt collector,
right?
And or training to fight again,
right?
Even though this could really threaten him physically, he's not there. He's not a young man anymore,
right?
So, interesting series. I've seen the first episode. I liked the first episode, but I haven't seen the rest.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's Lights Out on Netflix.
All right. So, which movie or TV show should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? Send your pick to feedback@filmspottingsvu.com or enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, April 9th at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, twitter.com/filmspottingsvu. And you'll have all that week to watch the film or TV show and then join our conversation on the next episode of Film Spotting SVU, which will be on Monday, April 16th.
And filmspottingsvu.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discussed on the show and TV shows as well. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie and TV recommendations and the review that you picked. In the meantime, you can follow me and Matt on Twitter at twitter.com/AllisonWilmore and twitter.com/MattSinger. And you can follow the show at twitter.com/FilmSpottingSVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we share more streaming suggestions from SVU listeners. From Film Spotting SVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Thanks for listening.